A similar situation developed when Professor Natta, who was responsible for the work, might slip my mind now, on the orientation. I'll have to fill that in on the preparation of polyolefins with oriented or linear structure.
Mm-hmm. Linear polyethylene.
Yeah, for the catalyst system. That was what the word I was trying to think of. The catalyst systems that. There was one other chemist that also contributed a great deal.
Ziegler.
Ziegler's work was very well known. Natta's work was also pioneering work in, and of course they got, I believe, a combined Nobel Prize for their work on catalytic systems for producing linear polyethylene. And actually I knew Natta very well. I'd met him many times at the in the course of the ISO work in Italy, meetings in Italy, both the through the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry meetings and the ISO meetings. And he and Mrs. Natta had invited us to their home just outside of Milan on one occasion, and we had a lunch with them, with Mrs. Natta. I believe he was elsewhere at the time, but Mrs. Natta invited my wife and I out to their home and served us a very special luncheon of the speciality of the region, which turned out to be sparrows that had been shot and cooked with their heads on. You can imagine biting into a sparrow and getting buckshot in your mouth. Well, we survived. But anyway, as I say, they were extremely cordial. Of course, Mrs. Natta, Professor Natta, of course, had become paralyzed, and she had to help him to walk. In fact, she would put her leg behind. He was paralyzed in one leg, and when he was going to walk to the podium, or to a seat, she would put one of her legs behind his and move it forward. He couldn't move the one leg forward. She was a marvelous woman. But as I say, we had become very close, and he had been in Washington on a couple of occasions, and I had entertained him locally in Washington. So when he received the Nobel Prize for his work on the catalytic systems for polymerization of olefins, I happened to be in England, and of course ICI had a copy of the Nobel Prize speech delivered in Italian, and they had translated it into English. And my good friend John Crawford, whom I had traveled through Germany with, and we had become great pals, gave me a copy of the ICI translation of Natta's Nobel Prize speech, which went into details regarding the whole process in much more detail than had previously been published.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously that was good material I couldn't credit John Crawford for, or ICI for the translation. I had to use it anonymously, but I knew that Natta was going to be in Washington shortly after I came back with that translation. So when we were having lunch together at a downtown restaurant, I said to him congratulated him on winning the Nobel Prize and on the talk that he had delivered in connection with the presentation, and I would like to publish that in Modern Plastics. And of course he didn't hesitate. He said of course, yeah. And so I went ahead and published it under his byline, of course, and shortly after it appeared in print, I got a very nasty letter from his associates in Milano asking me on what basis did I take the liberty of publishing Professor Natta's paper on the Nobel paper, and if I were going to publish it, why didn't I publish it in full, including the section on the crystallization of these monomers on the crystallization in polyethylene. And I said, well, I replied that I had had lunch with Dr. Natta in Washington, and he had given me permission to publish the report, and that the only reason I didn't publish the crystallization section was because I didn't have the photos that showed the crystallization. It was the only part of the paper that was meaningless without the pictures, you see. Mm-hmm. So I had to delete that part of the lecture. But if they would send me the pictures, I'd be glad to publish that section too. I never heard another word from them. So it takes a certain amount of brass, I guess, but I was fairly confident, knowing Natta so well, that why would he say no? It didn't mean anything to him, any reason why his talk shouldn't be published in Modern Plastics.
Right.
Yeah. There was also, I think, in this letter that they sent me, they said they had made some agreement with another publication in the United States, not a plastics magazine, but a scientific magazine, for publication. Well, in general, as far as Modern Plastics is concerned, we don't mind duplicating publication of a paper of that note, mm-hmm. which has appeared in another magazine. Of course, we observe copyright, but when you get permission from the author to publish something, you don't have to inquire about. I knew nothing about their plans or his plans. No, it wouldn't be Natta's plans. It would have been someone else in that laboratory that would have been dealing with that particular mm-hmm. aspect.
I'd like to ask one more question about the war, not so much about your own experiences, but what would you say the impact of the war was on the development of the plastics industry?
Oh, it was a very, very major...
How would you compare the plastics industry as it was and as the public perceived it, say, in 1938 with 1950 or with 1948? In other words, what did the war do to things?
I have summarized those thoughts in papers that I have over here, particularly every decade, at the end of every decade, I've published in Modern Plastics, well, every, I've published in Modern Plastics every year since 1940. I guess 1944, approximately, an annual review of developments in plastics, and then every, at the end of every decade, in other words, in 1940, 50, in January of 1940, 50, 60, 70, and 80, I have published a summary of the developments in plastics during that decade, and I have those comparisons of what took place from decade to decade in the records that I have over here.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your specific question, I would have to consult those decade reports to pinpoint specific developments, but I will say that as far as plastics were concerned, it was a whole new ball game after the end of the war, because of the fact that all of these plants had been built under government auspices for the production of the monomers and the polymers, and the industrial side, the civilian side of of applications of plastics was all set to take off a tremendous surge, which it did, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the what was when I first became technical editor of Modern Plastics was, I think, about 125 million pound industry has become as of now approximately a 50 billion pound industry. So you can see what a, and this I have some figures that I prepared which show that from decade to decade the growth of the industry from decade to decade, initially, I mean, I've forgotten the exact figures, but it's slowed down. Well, it was, I remember, sixfold, then down to threefold, then down to twofold, and they're predicting. The Stanford University has a survey out that they published in 73. I quoted it when I was elected as a charter member to the Plastics Hall of Fame in 1973. I predicted what was going to come by the year 2000 in plastics, and quoted the figures from the survey made by the Stanford group. They were predicting a growth of tenfold from 73 to the year 2000, and I think that adds up to 100 billion pounds in the year 2000. And as I say, we're now at 50 billion pounds. So I would say. And of course, a twofold increase would reach the 100 million from the present day level in the next 13 years. So they weren't too far off. It's just about to, the figures in recent decades show that the growth of the industry, both in, well, in production figures, I believe from 70 to 80, perhaps dropped off to a twofold increase, but that's a doubling, and so the Stanford figure isn't too far off. And a figure as far as relating to GNP, gross national product, is even more impressive. In other words, metals, glass, are going down as materials of construction and general use, and plastics are replacing those heavier materials and more, and as far as glass is concerned, a more fragile material. Mm-hmm. Of course, the problems of environment have to be resolved during this coming decade, too.
I think maybe we should...
My activities became more administrative, you see.
Uh-huh.
And the publications were publications of my colleagues in the division, and I was much more occupied with getting funds to support their work.
Well, we probably should talk a little bit about that tomorrow, too, about exactly how you went about getting funding.
Well, it's just a... I mean, most university chemistry departments know what it is. They go through this process all the time, trying to get money on government grants for research.
But did you find
the head men? It's no pleasure because it takes their time away from scientific activities. But they have to do it, and I had to do it. For the people that were working on the field. No, I think the ISO work we haven't covered at all.
No.
I want to mention that because that began in 51. I want to mention the publication of this analytical chemistry of polymers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a significant contribution at that time. Of course, it's hopelessly out of date now, but that's the way things go. I have some figures on how fast knowledge becomes obsolete. In one of these papers that I looked over, surprising that I something to the effect that in one decade 50% of the knowledge becomes obsolete. So in two decades 25%, in three decades 12.5% is still pertinent, and so this winds up in four decades down to around 6% of the knowledge that you had when you began 40 years ago is now obsolete. So it's the same with this book, the analytical chemistry of polymers in its day was the source of information, but the primary source of information. But today it's out of date.
And I noticed the one at the copy of the second two volumes that they have at the University of Texas Library is still checked out all the time.
Yeah, there's some basic information, but actually there's so much new information. It may be from the historical angle or from the background angle that it's of importance, but I have no illusions about it being any really useful source that's of more interest for background information. Mm-hmm. So, I think the
a note on the evening of May 15th. The previous fragment was recorded as Dr. Klein and I were closing out the interview sessions for today, and we began plotting out what we would discuss tomorrow. And when I mentioned that we would cover what he had done subsequently to 1951, he began by saying that he was primarily involved in administrative things. At which point I felt that it was worthwhile to turn the recorder back on for a second. This is the morning of May 16th, and this is Jeffrey Meikle continuing the interview with Dr. Gordon M. Klein at Lake Worth, Florida. And we had yesterday carried our discussions through the World War II period and into the 1950s. And I'll start this morning simply by asking you how your work at the Bureau changed during the post-war era, and what kinds of things you found yourself concerned with primarily?
Well, beginning with the decade of the 50s, my responsibilities changed rather drastically. Up to that time, of course, I had been the chief of the plastic section, and in 1951 I was promoted to the chief of the division, which covered some 5 or 6 sections. Also, in 1950, the question of participation in international standards arose, and I was chairman of the ASTM Committee D20 on plastics at that time. So we appointed a committee headed by Ed Cooper of the DuPont Company to sound out the industry on participation in the international standards activities and their willingness to support a secretariat for such activity in the American National Standards Institute. So the committee reported back that they felt that it was desirable to participate and accept the offer of the ISO, which is the International Standardization Organization, accept the responsibility for the secretariatship. We made a survey in early 1950 of committee members, and I think we received just one negative vote. It's a very interesting response from a very good friend of mine that was in the industry, but it's typical of some of the attitude toward international participation. I'll read this very short statement. "I believe the benefits to be gained by participation will not justify the effort, and that it is optimistic in the extreme to think that the work can largely be done in ASTM meetings. An ASTM representative at an international meeting will have his hands tied anyway and can be outvoted at will." This is by other countries. "As long as we are giving everything away, why not retain the right to specify what we are giving and how to test it?" That was the only negative.
Who was that from?
Actually from Joe Ryan of Libby Owens Ford Glass Company. He was a very outspoken individual, but I played poker with him many times, and he was not quite as uncooperative as that particular response would indicate. Well, this led to the first meeting. Well, first let me say that realizing that this international standards activity was going to take a considerable amount of my time, I consciously made the decision that my assistant in the plastic section, Frank Reinhart, would take over the responsibility for the work on the primary responsibility for the work on ASTM standards in Committee D20, and that I would devote my time on standards work to the ISO standards. The reason that I did this is based on an early experience in my career at the National Bureau of Standards. The chief of the division in which I worked had a background entirely in inorganic materials, mm-hmm. and had transferred over to the division to head the division of organic and fibrous materials from the cement division of the National Bureau of Standards, and the time that the division was organized?
His name.
Oh, Emily? Mr. Emily, yes. He was very much interested in organizational activities, but of course he had no background whatsoever in the organic material field, and when the ASTM committee was set up, he found himself as chairman the first chairman of that committee, which was perfectly logical since he had participated in all the early discussions on the organization of such work in ASTM. But then about a year or two later, a federal specifications committee was organized.
This was in the 40s, right? Wasn't
no,
it?
this is still in the 30s.
In the 30s.
In the 30s, yes. And the this federal specifications committee was composed of plastics experts from the various government agencies, military and civilian, that would be concerned with uses, applications of plastics, and of course they wanted the federal specifications to cover the materials that were going to be used. The federal specifications, the proposal was that again Mr. Emily head up that particular group, even though in no way could he classify as an expert in plastics, and this was so absurd that I went down to his office. This was about 37, and said to him, Mr. Emily, if you are going to be the plastics expert at the National Bureau of Standards, I'm leaving. And this, of course, took him somewhat aback, but he quickly assured me that in no way would he take over such responsibilities, and that he would nominate me for the chairman of that particular committee. And from then on, we had no difficulty and worked cooperatively. I remember one incident at a section chief's meeting in the division that we were discussing the capabilities of Frank Reinhart, and he said, well, there's one thing that I'd like to say. Now that Frank Reinhart is assistant chief of the plastics section, I no longer worry about whether you are enticed to leave the Bureau of Standards. And the one of the other section chiefs spoke up and said, well, that's a sign of a good executive. But anyway, we got along. There were no there was no difficulty in working with Mr. M. Lee. He finally accepted the fact that